us now, Srinath Sripad here. We are again with yet another episode of Talking World Cup, made special by the fact that we're talking to an actual World Cup winner, a Champions Trophy winner, and I'm not saying this because we have you on the show, one of the few Australian cricketers I loved watching thoroughly, the one and only Mr. Cricket, Mike Hussey. Welcome on the show, Mike.
G'day, guys. Great to be here.
Great. Gaurav Sundaraman is also in the house as always. He's not a World Cup winner, so I'm not going to introduce him. Hey, Gaurav.
Good, and it's just amazing to be doing a podcast with even my idol and being a hardcore Aussie fan from India. So it's just a great feeling to be here.
Mike, how have you been enjoying Australia's progress in the World Cup so far, and how do you rate them with your winning teams?
I've been really impressed, actually, because you think back only probably just 6 months to a year ago and the team was in turmoil. I think they'd lost something like 19 out of 21 one-day internationals. Obviously, Smith and Warner were suspended, and a lot of people weren't giving Australia much chance at all in this World Cup. But just probably a couple of months out from the World Cup, they built a bit of momentum, got a good game plan together, picked some really good players, and started getting some consistent performances. And then, obviously, you inject back into the team two world-class players in Smith and Warner, and things are looking good. I've been impressed with the way they've played. Still not perfect, but, I mean, it's good that they're sort of building momentum, hopefully to play their best cricket at the back end.
Yeah, one thing a lot of us in India, I think I'm sure around the world as well, wonder is this whole concept of the winning culture. Some of these things, these are softer aspects which don't get discussed as much as on-field performances. How important is a winning culture like Australia's, and how much is the whole past history going to, spur them on to further successes in this World Cup?
Oh, I'm sure it'll spur them on, no question about that. But it's still, you've still got to do it with your current team there. But I think they're quite lucky. They've got some great experience around the team. Obviously, Mitchell Starc was part of the last World Cup win. There's Steve Smith, obviously, probably a couple other players as well. But then you've got Brad Haddin's the fielding coach. He was part of the World Cup win in 2015. Justin Langer, the coach, with Ricky Ponting. Obviously, he knows a fair bit about winning World Cups. So there's a lot of experience there, and they know what it takes to win World Cups. And so they put the things in place for the players to follow. And they're looking good, but obviously there's some big challenges out there as well. There's some other good teams. India are obviously looking really good. I don't know. I would have said England at the start of the tournament, but they're sort of a bit wobbly at the moment.
Everybody said England. I don't think anybody called the fact that England won't make it.
Yeah, exactly. Me neither.
Hmm. We, not all of us, called Australia to be one of the favourites. Oh, I did. I'll just brag about it again. Have you been pleasantly surprised as a long-term Aussie fan in terms of how it's panned out? Because obviously there's the whole 1999 keeps coming back, because during the tournament they had a series of must-win games and stuff like that. This time, despite the precedent and the period that followed, it's been smooth sailing to the semis.
It's a big surprise, but one stat which comes to my mind, between World Cup 2015 and the start of World Cup 2019, Australia's big four, if you call it, Starc, Cummins, Warner and Smith, I think they just played 6 ODIs in which all 4 of them actually played. So take out Kohli, Rohit, Bumrah and maybe Chahal, and then see if India, how India would have done in that 4-year period. So that's how I looked at it. So, though outside maybe I was not very confident, inside I had a feeling that they've never played this set. And if you actually play these 4, it makes a big difference. So if every team, you take out 4 really good players, or maybe Australia just didn't try these players. They don't look at the bilaterals as important as other tournaments. And
is that true, Mike? Ashes and World Cup are top priority, and the rest of it is...
It is difficult these days, with the schedule being so busy, to play all the players in all the games. It's just physically and mentally impossible. So, yeah, there are a lot of players getting rested, particularly the fast bowlers rotate around a lot as well. So they put guys like Pat Cummins, Mitchell Starc, Josh Hazlewood in cotton wool at various stages, which is a bit foreign for me because it took me so long to get into the Australian team. I didn't want to rest any games. Yeah. I wanted to play every game possible. But I've come to realise that, with the schedule
with the
and other T20s,
and stuff,
20 leagues around the place, it's just impossible.
And the fact that Maxwell and Finch didn't sign up for the IPL, those are signs, that they wanted the World Cup really badly. And it's Maxwell. He's a million-dollar player.
He's a gun T20 player, yeah.
Whatever said and done about his performances, he's always going to go for that money. So next year, he's very well set up to, because he's one of those few marquee players in the auction.
That might have been part of his tactic as well, though.
Yeah. It's a small auction, and I'm pretty sure I'd be very surprised if Maxwell's not a millionaire. So leaving that aside, the fact that they rested and they prepared for this tournament and the Ashes definitely shows that they make these tournaments as key and they give it their best. And ultimately, again, it has to work and they have to win it. But the fact that they've done so well clearly shows that big tournaments are important for them.
It is statistically not expected, but historically completely expected for Australia to kind of boss their way through the league. That's what I feel, at least. I'm going to ask you about Ricky Ponting, who's part of the coaching staff. You've obviously played with both Justin and Ricky Ponting, Justin Langer and Ricky Ponting. How much does coaching actually help through a tournament like this? Because he's around, I think, only till the end of the World Cup and probably for a bit of the Ashes. How much does an appointment like this help? And talk us through your memories from 2011 and 7 with working with Ponting as the captain in the change room. How big a presence will he be?
Well, he'll be huge. I think for a lot of the current players, he was a bit of an idol for them growing up. So to have them in the dressing room, have him in the dressing room is, I think they were a bit starstruck initially. But then Ricky's such a great communicator and he understands the game so well, and he understands, well, particularly batting as well, that as soon as he broke down those sort of starry eyes players then and just got into work, he just loves getting in and working hard with the players. That they would really warm to everything he says. As I said, he articulates his understanding of the game so well. He's such a driven person. So I remember as a player and as a captain, he was just so driven to win and win the big tournaments with Australia. He wanted to make sure every player in the team was at their best. He would help you get the best out of yourself. He'd prepare and plan so well. You should have seen him train. You know, he was training like it was the World Cup final in every single net session, every fielding session, you know, so he set such high standards. And I know he'll bring that to this particular team as well. And he will, obviously not for his own game anymore, but he'll be imparting all of his knowledge and his work rate onto those current players, so they've got a good chance of getting the best out of themselves.
It's interesting you say that, because Justin Langer is obviously the permanent long-term coach. Mm. You spoke about how you would give a pep talk and Justin Langer would give a pep talk versus what Ricky Ponting would do, I think, in one of our video shows a couple of days ago, as to just go out there and knock the English boys out, for example, because he's naturally a more aggressive sort of leader, isn't he, compared to the other guys in the change room.
Yeah, well, both Langer and Ponting are extremely competitive and combative, really, that they want to take the opposition head on. And that's a bit the Australian way. You know, we will try and fight fire with fire as much as we can. That's just sort of the way we're brought up. I think it's really important for Justin to have someone like Ricky there, that they're very good friends and they trust each other implicitly. So Justin's obviously only been in the job for probably about a year now. Yeah, so it's important for him to have a couple of lieutenants that are really close to him that he can communicate with. He can bounce ideas off, and I think Ricky's the perfect guy for Justin. Obviously, Ricky commands so much respect in the dressing room as well. So I think it's a great combination, and I think they together will challenge each other, but they'll also keep each other grounded as well, because I know Justin sometimes can get a little bit intense and a little bit emotional, and I'm sure Ricky can just sort of, you know, keep him in check at times, and maybe a bit vice versa as well. So I think they'll work really well together.
The other question I had, I saw Ricky Ponting coach for Delhi Capitals this time. You had Shreyas Iyer as a captain, who is a very young captain who's not had enough experiences. So it looked like Ponting was running the show. Even at the toss, Shreyas used to say that the support staff felt that we need to bowl first and we're bowling first and so on and so forth. I see a parallel with Finch, who's young, who's just captain Renegades to the Big Bash victory. At the same time, he's very new to the ODI job as such. So do you think that he would be a captain who would actually kind of have a game plan which Ponting and Langer say, and he would follow it to the T, or is it better that Finch is the captain rather than a Steve Smith who would have been into the business for 3-4 years?
I think it would be very much working together. I think Aaron Finch, maybe if you rewound probably a year or 2 years ago, he wasn't as confident as a captain as he is now. I think he's really evolved a lot in the last 12 or so months. He was someone that used to get really angry on the field, lose control, lose his emotions. It's something he's really worked on. He's much more in control now. As far as the tactics and things like that, I believe it'd be a two-way street. I think Justin and Ricky and the other support staff would be feeding Aaron Finch all the information, and then they'd probably get Aaron Finch's idea about how he sort of thinks the game should be played. Because at the end of the day, the captain's the one taking the team on the field. He has to make the tough calls in those 50-50 moments. So I think they'd give a lot of autonomy to Aaron to run things his way, but they would certainly challenge him in his tactics as well.
I remember, Huss, when Australia were touring India recently, there was an Indian journalist asking Aaron Finch if he's the permanent captain. And when Smith returns, will he get back to the leadership role? It was sort of a pointed question. It had something behind it. And Finch was so calm and said that he's the permanent captain. And remember, he was going through a patch where Bhuvneshwar Kumar was getting him out. He seems one of the calmest guys going around in terms of captains. He doesn't get flustered in front of the media. There are tough questions. It's been a tough year for Australia since Newlands. He seems to be a lot calmer now than, you know, somebody like Owen Morgan, I mean, to draw a recent parallel. He seems to be so much more in control of things as a captain. Does that have to do with winning and, you know?
Well, Australia weren't really winning at that stage of the game when he was going through personally bad form and the team had been losing a lot. But that's where I think he's really evolved as a captain. He knew the direction that the team was going and the path they were on. He saw himself as a big part of that. It would have been a big call to remove him as captain at that stage, so close to a World Cup. He just needed to find some runs. That's all it sort of came down to, and his confidence would have come. But I'm sure on the outside, he would have been appearing very calm and in control and stoic in that he's the man to lead the team. But I'm sure inside, he would have had plenty of doubts. Every player has that self-doubt and one about your form, whether he's the right man to lead the team, etc. But he's a class player. And so I knew he was going to come out of the batting rut at some stage. All class players do. So once he came out of that, he really started to hit some good form, and he's taken that into the World Cup. And I think he's led the team really well. But I think he really has grown and evolved as a captain in the last year or so.
Just to take a quick digression before we get back to the World Cup, is it cricket a unique sport in that you fail more often than you succeed? That seems to be a more common sort of thought going around among coaches and players and generally in the media. Do you see it as a different sport compared to a lot of other sports, or is it just the same, and how does a player like Finch or anyone else deal with it?
Well, I have no doubt that you fail more than you have good days. I, in fact, asked that exact same question to Shane Warne, one of the arguably in the top five players that have ever played the game in the history of the game. And he said he probably had 51% good days and 49% bad days. So that sort of tells me that if one of the greatest players of all time is just on 50%, then the rest of us are going to be sort of a fair bit lower than that. I guess it's similar to other sports. I think of baseball, you know, if you're batting at, 300, then you're actually doing really well. So 3 out of 10 times you're actually scoring a run or getting on base or whatever it may be. So it's tough. International sport is really tough. How you deal with it is important. You just got to somehow put it behind you, keep looking forward, keep being positive, and that's where I think the environment of the team is really important, to keep backing the players, keep showing trust in them and knowing that they'll repay that faith when they get on a good run.
Interesting you talk about coaching culture, then it takes me back to 2015 when you were part of the South African setup, South African World Cup setup. So how different was it? Because South Africa, another key match, another key tournament, it might be the complete opposite of Australia from what, as a fan, as a neutral, as a person who's watching the game, we look at South Africa and Australia as complete opposites when it comes to big tournaments, right? Did you get that sense of a feeling in 2015? Could you give us some anecdotes about what really happened during that stint, the way in which the teams actually were operating?
And South Africa also very process-driven, similar to Australia in that sense, but somehow at World Cups it doesn't seem to be really happening.
I actually was really impressed with the South African setup in 2015 for that World Cup. The way they went about their cricket was incredible. They had some really fantastic players. They had a great environment. And certainly they have some challenges, obviously, with their race, the different races in their country. If there's a quota system, if there's not a quota system, and there's all that sort of external distraction there. So how they deal with that is amazing, really. I think coming from Australia, where, if I'm honest, there's a lot of ego, there's a lot of in your face and aggression, and that's how we play our cricket. South Africa, who I think the way they went about it, their training and their meetings and planning and everything was very similar. But I felt in the environment they were so humble and they were so respectful of the different races and colours and religions in the team, which I was blown away by. I thought they played some brilliant cricket. I thought the preparation in the lead up to the semi-final against New Zealand was amazing. But then literally the day before the semi-final, I don't know, that's when I sort of thought, well, this is different. Selection, there was a small selection change in there as well, which I wasn't sure how that was going to affect the team either. Kyle Abbott was left out when he was bowling brilliantly. Yeah. Vernon Philander had come back from a hamstring injury. And so from a team that I felt just prepared magnificently, we're in a great space, to suddenly we got to the day before the semi-final and, I don't know, there was just a different feeling in the room. And I felt as though in the lead-up, New Zealand had no chance of winning that semi-final. But then as soon as we finished that meeting, I felt as though it was going to be a 50-50 ball game. And as it turned out, it was an amazing match. I still think South Africa played some really good cricket and were unlucky. I think the rain came at just the wrong time when they were dominating with the bat. And give some credit to New Zealand. The way they chased down, which is still a stiff target, was pretty incredible as well. It was an amazing game of cricket.
So in terms of culture, there is some amount of similarity between South Africa and Australia, but maybe in the finer aspects, maybe Australia is slightly different.
Similar in a lot of ways, but then there are some big differences as well. Obviously, the different cultures, although we're starting to get a lot more different cultures in Australia as well. We're getting, you know, some Indians and Pakistanis and that playing, you know, through the ranks. And but in South Africa, where there's so many different races and regions and colours, and how respectful and humble they were about all those, it was just amazing. It was a phenomenal environment.
Just to conclude on the South Africa bit and the Australia section, on a big day, just when you have these 2-3 knockout games, general preparation that you spoke about, this whole big game mentality is something that we talk about. We are outsiders. We obviously don't play elite sport or international sport. But as outsiders, we love reading those narratives about the whole big game mentality. This guy is a clutch player. He will turn up. I'm sure I've thought of you in those terms.
Or maybe when Hazi's about to finish a game, or yeah, you've finished so many games. It's a clutch game. Let's talk about the world T20 semi-final.
The whole Sai Ajmal thing, for example.
So what goes to your mind in that time, and How does pressure really affect you? Because pressure is a word used so much in sport, and there are certain people who are genuinely good and certain people who are bad. You know, when you watch as a fan, I can put my money saying that this guy is not going to do it for me.
I will pick that guy in my fantasy team. For
yeah, and, you, and you've been with a particular one of the best guys under pressure for the last, 10 years or whatever. So could you take us into your mind first?
First of all, we always laugh when I hear outsiders and that sort of say, oh, this is a clutch moment, or this is a huge game, or, you know, it's actually not. It's just another ball, or it's just another game. And, yes, we're human. We know it's a World Cup final, or it's an IPL final, or whatever it may be. But it doesn't mean you have to try harder than you have in every other game. It's just about doing the process, playing each ball as well as you possibly can. And that's the secret, really. People that try and build it up too much, or they think they've got to do more and play the most amazing, and that's where they fall apart. You in a pressure situation, I guess the mistake that a lot of people make is they start focusing on the end result. I need to hit a six off this ball. We need to hit a six, but you might not. You need to actually just watch the ball. If it's a good ball or a good Yorker, you've just got to try and get a single on it. So you've got to always bring it back to the process. The funny story about the T20 World Cup in the West Indies in that semi-final against Pakistan, that the crazy thing is I'd basically given up. So all of the tension, all of the stress, all the pressure that you're talking about, I said, well, we're going to lose. So
let's watch the ball, might as well.
Let's just have a swing, see what happens, and if we get close, then we do. But like Cameron White got out, he threw all his gear in the bin because he knew that was it, we were done. And I thought, oh, well. And so all that stress and tension that I had, the pressure that it just sort of dissipated out of my body, and I felt relaxed, I felt calm. I wasn't even worrying about winning or losing. I was just playing the game. And then the only time I felt all that stress and pressure and anxiety and tension come back into my body was when we needed to hit one run off two balls. That was the first time it all came back to me. I was just screaming at myself saying, please, just hit this ball in the middle, just hit this ball in the middle. And thankfully it did. But, Yeah, it was just one of those crazy, crazy days.
We'll keep that in mind the next time we write 800 words on clutch moments.
It'll become 8 words.
Yeah.
There's no pressure. We thought we lost the game, but we hit the 6 and we won the game.
Where the game turned, it didn't.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Dhoni, because the fact that you've been so close to him while you finish games, and then there's this guy who consistently does it. The whole world looks up to him. The whole world is calm when he's at the crease. People know that he knows how to go about doing this whole chasing, playing under pressure, doesn't get fluttered at all. So did you learn from him? Jenny, take us through as what you think is his
secret.
Well, I think he was incredibly calm. No matter how tight the game got, he used to always say, you know, he who panics last will win the game.
Even this year against Rajasthan also?
Yeah, that was probably out of character. Never seen anything like that before, but that was amazing. But I remember batting with him, and I was always the anxious and stressed one because I didn't have the power. I knew I couldn't clear the fence unless I really got it out of the middle. He had the enormous power, so he always had that to fall back on. But I'd be stressing that we need 12 runs and over, and he would always just calm down and say, don't worry. And he read the game so well. He knew exactly who was going to bowl. He knew exactly who he could get 25 runs off. He knew exactly who we just had to just take it easy against. He mapped it all out in his mind before it actually even happened. And he always seemed to be one step ahead of the opposition. Whereas I couldn't think as clearly as that. I was always like, well, I'm not sure what they're going to do. If they do this, I'll try this. And I could only play like maybe a few balls ahead. But he almost had the whole run chase just mapped out in his head. And it used to annoy me because he used to take it down to the last over, the last ball so many times. And I'd say, can you please just do it an over earlier? You know, you're giving me too many grey hairs here. And he used to just smile and laugh. And
we'll pass this on to the thousands of Indian fans thinking the same every time he bats these days.
But he was wonderful to bat with. But it must be nice knowing that he's got this power that he can clear the fence. And I think that pressure gets put back on the bowler. That they know when they're running in bowling to MS, if they just miss, it's gone. It's gone for 6.
So they're playing the reputation of the guy at that point.
Yeah, without doubt. Whereas if they're bowling the same ball to me, then they've probably got a 50, well, maybe a 70% chance of the ball not going out of the park, you know?
That's you being super humble, Mike. Absolutely no doubt
to
wrap up the World Cup section of this whole episode. Two things I want to ask you. One is the fact that accumulators like Joe Root are thriving at this World Cup. Not just him. I'm thinking of Shakib Al Hasan as well. Guys who do play the dot balls, but they are strike rotators at their core, right? They can find the boundary, the odd boundary. But this World Cup in England, because it's not living to type in that there's no 350, 380 every other day, these guys seem to be thriving. Yeah. And one guy who comes to mind is you and your batting over the years. You're not, like you said, a big, particularly big six hitter. You're not known to clear the boundary as your core skill, right? Mm. You seem to always find the gaps, nudge it around. Even a guy like David Warner, sometimes he does it when he's not finding the boundaries. Are you surprised that this is happening given what's been happening in England over the last 3-4 years?
Well, that's probably why I'm not surprised that guys are struggling to rotate the strike, because they've been used to playing on good surfaces and just being able to smash boundaries at will almost. So suddenly I've really enjoyed this World Cup because the bowlers have been able to get into the contest. There's been a little bit of movement there, and you start seeing the players that have got true batsmanship skills really come to the fore. Guys like Shakib and Joe Root. I think Steve Smith does it pretty well. Virat Kohli's probably the best out of all of them. Being able to rotate the strike when it's not that easy to bat on is just, it's a great skill. And it's not easy, and it's showing the class of those batsmen coming through.
Underrated.
It's highly underrated. And it's no coincidence, I guess, that those players are really thriving at this World Cup when the scores have been lower and the pitches have been a little bit more difficult to bat on. And the guys that are normally been smashing it out of the park are just finding it a little bit more tricky.
Hmm. And finally, you've played a lot with guys who won the 2015 World Cup in Australia. For England, do you think the weight of expectations of playing at home is kind of hitting them hard at this stage? Because that's something that some teams tackle much better than others. Mm. And how do you think Australia did it last time as opposed to what England are trying to do this time? We've seen Johnny Bairstow come out and say that fans put them under pressure as opposed to actually driving them on and supporting them.
I must admit, I was really surprised to hear those comments coming out of the England camp. And that's a bit alarm bells for me. from their point of view. I think if they're worrying about all that sort of stuff, the external distractions, and their mind's not on what it needs to be on the job at hand. So I think as a team, they need to come together pretty quickly. They need to get their minds back on the job at hand and not be focusing on all that. I think personally, it's just because the pitches have been different to what they've been used to. In the last 2 years, basically been playing on really good pitches and just smashing 350, 360, 400 in games. And suddenly they're coming to this World Cup against good bowling attacks, but the pitches have had a little bit in it for the bowlers, and that style of play hasn't actually worked. Now, I must admit, coming to this World Cup, I thought it was going to be flat pitches and huge scores. But because the surfaces haven't actually been like that, it's really not suited England's game plan. And they haven't been able to adapt, other than probably a Joe Root. He's been very good at it. But they just haven't been able to show that the other batsmen haven't been able to show those batsmanship skills to adapt to trickier batting conditions. So the challenge is there for them. I still think they're good enough to get through. They're going to have to play two very good games, especially to beat India. But I'm not saying it can't be done. And we're going to find out a lot about England's character in the next two games. If they succumb to that pressure that you're talking about, the external stuff, then we're gonna have to say that they've, you know, it's been a really bad failed campaign again. But if they actually get through, then you know, it shows they've got a fair bit of ticker.
And very early in sport, any sport, England start off as favourites in a world competition. So I'm sure the outcome, the fact that they were very confident of making the semis, and then they would have, I think in their mind they would have felt that, I think we surely will make the semis from there. Let's play two matches and we'll plan. And suddenly you're in a situation where I think the Sri Lanka loss has completely changed their mental approach.
They've done the World Cup a favour. We're all having fun looking at the
no running. More than an Australian sitting here, I can tell you. But
as a Australian growing up, which is any favourite World Cup memory of yours? Which is your favourite World Cup match or any particular moment you just enjoyed?
Growing up, well, I really fell in love with the 99 World Cup. Especially the back end. Obviously, Australia was struggling earlier on, but towards the back end in those must-win games against South Africa, the Steve Waugh century at Headingley, I think it was, when Herschel Gibbs dropped the catch.
And the World Cup.
that's the story that goes with it. And then, the semi-final at Edgbaston that went right down to the wire, and Alan Donald not running, and, the drama with that was just incredible. I couldn't stay up to watch the game because it was too late in Australia, but I woke up the next day. I'd had it taped, so I sat there the whole next day and watched the game out.
Did you know the result before you saw it?
No, but my wife she stayed up and watched it, would you believe?
Wow.
And she, when I woke up in the morning, she said, she just said, "You've got to watch this match." So that's all she said, so... Yeah, it was incredible. So that was just incredible to watch Australia win that World Cup. And then obviously to be part of a World Cup team in 2007 was amazing. I don't think I've been part of a team in my entire life that has just planned and executed so well as that team did in that World Cup.
No wonder they say that 2007 World Cup was the most dominating, as in single most dominating performance by any team. I think there was not even a close game.
Yeah. It was unbelievable to be part of it. And we had some stars, some superstars. You know, you talk Ricky Ponting, Adam Gilchrist, Glenn McGrath, but we had so many unsung heroes as well. Guys like Nathan Bracken, Brad Hogg,
Sean Tate,
another one, exactly. So that was what it was so good. It was great to be part of it.
Right? Can Australia repeat the heroics and go on to secure a sixth title? That would be in line with type and the history. On that note, Mike Hussey, thanks a lot for joining us and talking World Cup. It's been a pleasure.
No worries. Thanks for having me, guys.
Right. Thanks, Gaurav. And thanks to you, listener. Look forward to your company once again and talking World Cup. We'll be out with an episode very soon. Remember to leave us a rating on iTunes. It helps more and more people find the podcast. And of course, you can listen to it elsewhere as well. Google Podcasts, Spotify, Audio Boom, or anywhere else. Until next time then, thanks a lot. And goodbye from all of us at ESPN Cricket.